Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Write Club. The first rule of Write Club is you don't talk about Write Club, but we'll make an exception in your case.
Nicola here, the techie one. Apologies, we're still having a few technical issues with our sound, so we've done our best with this one and we hope it doesn't spoil your enjoyment too much. We're working on getting it fixed as soon as possible.
Hello and welcome to Write Club, the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. I'm Nicola and today I'm with Teresa, Linda, Heather, Steph and Pat.
Hello!
Hi!
This week on Write Club we're talking about writers' retreats, workshops and intensive courses, ways to take time out of our busy lives and focus on nothing but writing without interruptions or distractions. Pat and Teresa were lucky to have spoken to crime writer Graham Smith, who also runs a crime writers' retreat, so I think you'll find that interesting. Pat is going to share her work in progress with us, and after she's read it to us, we'll be offering her feedback and critique just the way we do in our Write Club meetings. Heather has a word of the week for us, and at the end of the show, Steph and Sam Blake are going to share what's on their bedside tables. But before all that, Teresa is going to ask us to
name the novel.
I am, and I've got a really easy one for you this week. Honestly.
easy for British people.
No.
Did you hear the disbelieving silence?
Clue one. Okay. Published posthumously in 2005, this novel quickly became an international bestseller.
I know it.
Yeah,
I possibly know it just from
yes,
that.
You yes, you can. Yes, you can.
Yeah.
An idea.
I know
yeah,
it is.
Okay. Clue two.
Oh, I might know it.
There you go. The first of a trilogy.
Yes. Definitely what I don't do.
Introduces an original contemporary heroine and has been filmed twice.
Yep.
Got it.
Shall I go on? Clue three. A further two novels have been added to the original trilogy since the author's death.
Oh.
Right. I didn't know that.
One. I didn't know there were two.
Yeah.
As I've never had one, I don't.
Go on, Nicola, tell us.
The girl with the dragon tattoo by Sue Glass.
Yeah. Is that the first time you've ever got one?
I think it's the third time.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
Do you?
We stopped keeping track of this a long time ago.
Yes, because none of us wanted to know the scores.
So, as Nicola said, the answer was The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo by Stieg Larsson. The original Swedish title, however, was to be translated into English as Men Who Hate Women.
Oh!
But Girl with the Dragon Tattoo is much catchier title, isn't it?
Yeah.
And the unconventional heroine is Lisbeth Salander, I'm sure you all remember.
Yeah.
So the original trilogy was The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, The Girl Who Played with Fire,
and the girl who kicked the horn.
David Lagercrantz has since continued this because, as I said, these were published posthumously.
Yeah.
With the Girl in the Spider's Web, which came out in 2015, and The Girl Who Takes an Eye for an Eye in 2017.
Have you read those?
No, I read the first of those. I didn't realise there was a second.
No, I didn't.
And I wasn't desperate to see if there were any more to follow. It
didn't grab you the way the original
Whether it's
did.
Just, you know, it was a character and a story that had run its course or not, I don't know. And
they're just sort of cashing in on the franchise now.
Yeah. Like those TV series, you know.
Yeah.
Start off great, and then by about series four or five, you think.
They always make one series too many.
Oh, yeah.
She's a very, very relatable heroine, isn't she?
Well,
I love all the computer bits.
She's born a particular style. I can't think of specifics, but that.
A genre of feisty female.
Yeah.
Well, also damaged females. Yeah. Like Homeland is a damaged heroine, isn't it?
Yeah. I haven't seen that.
Girl with bipolar disorder.
Case in point, that started off brilliantly.
Mm-hmm.
But by about four or five, it can't start.
Anyway.
Who's in charge?
Oh, I am. I'm sitting here enjoying myself. Thank you, Teresa. And now it's time for Pat to read to us from her work in progress.
Thank you. This was kind of not inspired by, but although it was an idea that had been festering at the back of my mind for a while, I think maybe my Christmas sojourn in sunnier climes is what prompted me to actually get It's a pen to paper. And it's called, well, provisionally, possibly temporarily, it's called Coming Home. Ah, my friend, welcome back. Welcome. Yanni's huge paw grasped Joe's and a smile of genuine warmth split his face. Here, sit. My brother's house. It is okay? Everything as you like? I will bring coffee and do so, and we will talk. You will tell me your plans. Not giving Joe a chance to respond, he bustled into the cool interior of the small cafenium. Joe shook his head and laughed. Sitting on one of the small blue chairs, he turned his face to the sun, feeling the warm breeze like a blessing on his skin, still pale from the English winter, and thinner now. He'd been coming to Seagree every summer for 18 years, and this was always his first call after dropping off his luggage. Yanni's Cafenion in the small square by the church, with its view over the bay. From here you could see everything. The comings and goings in the square, but also the workings of the tiny harbour below, and the seafront with its three tavernas overlooking the narrow strip of beach. As always, he booked onto the earliest possible flight after term finished, impatient to return to the village he called his second home. His first visit, all those years ago, had been on a package holiday, chosen because the resort was part of the tour company's off-the-beaten-track selection. He booked in the hope that at the very least there would be some reasonable food and some peace and quiet. His luggage allowance was mainly used up with a goodly selection of books. In the event, Seagree had far exceeded his limited expectations. There was wonderful food. There was warmth. There was friendship. The place was a balm to the soul. He'd fallen in love with it, with a way of life that had a simplicity to it that he yearned to be a part of. But he had a job. He had elderly parents. There were bills to pay. He couldn't simply abandon his life. Instead, the annual 2 weeks became three, sometimes even four, and although it was a long journey, he occasionally visited at Easter, if the Greek Orthodox feast fell within his two-week break. Soon, the villagers welcomed him as a friend. He attended their weddings, their christenings, even danced at the Panagia. Eventually, he could look ahead to retirement, and he knew where he wanted to be. Within a year of each other, both parents died, leaving him a little money. He spoke to the pensions people, did his sums, and decided he could probably afford to retire a little earlier than he'd anticipated. His heart beat faster at the prospect. He began to make plans. To talk to his brothers, he emailed Yanni and asked if he could find him a cottage or an apartment to rent. And when he was sure that his dream could indeed become reality, he spoke to the head and told her he would be retiring at the end of the summer term. And now, here he was.
Mm. Are you planning for this to be a short story, or a long short story, or a start of a novel?
Short story.
A short story. Mm. Okay.
That was one of my questions.
Yeah.
It was such a...
I should have said.
No, it's okay. It's just that that will affect some of my observations.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can I jump in? Yeah. I absolutely loved it. It sounds like an idyllic place to go on holiday. That Taverna's got the view to die for, isn't it? I really loved it. The writing just completely made me feel like I was there. It was really lovely.
Yeah.
I'm delighted to have spotted a my eyes met the donkeys moment. Do you remember in my work in progress when his eyes slid along the line of donkeys and they met mine?
I've
spotted the donkey's eyes moment.
Oh, God.
tell us. Which is when it's a bit thinner now. I wasn't sure if it was his skin that was thinner or if he was thinner.
Yeah, I got that. You were talking about the skin.
Yeah.
I knew someone else would get it. That's why I had to jump in
first. His skin still pale from the English winter and thinner now. Not his skin.
But that really was the only thing I could find to in it. It was beautifully written.
I actually thought that line, like a blessing on his skin, still powerful nutrient. I thought that actually piqued our curiosity beautifully. Mm-hmm. Why is he thinner now? I mean, notwithstanding that maybe you can make
it. I thought
that
was what he meant to be his skin, and I wasn't sure about
it. Okay.
But it's so odd.
Yeah, I know. I wasn't comfortable with it.
Yeah.
And I thought, I'll put it in and see what I'm saying.
But it certainly,
people say.
Certainly piques your curiosity. Why is his skin bad, or why is he thinner? What's happened to him to cause that?
Mm.
I love the fact that you're writing something set in Greece, because remember your girl's holiday story?
Yes.
I really enjoyed that too. You've got a really good way of doing
that
it.
That just ran away with itself. I need to go back to it.
And I think that kind of writing has a lot of commercial possibilities, because it is everybody's fantasy. Well, it's a lot of people's fantasy to retire early to somewhere warm.
Right.
And so many people will read books that deal with those kind of stories just so they can experience it vicariously.
Yeah. I mean, I was sucked in. Mm. I've still got that great thirst for those stories.
Yeah. I just thought that I marked like a blessing on his skin as being one of those beautiful, beautiful descriptions.
So
and then further along, the place was a balm to the soul, and I felt those were lovely related words, you know, a blessing and a balm. And I like that very much, continuing through the story. I thought it was a lovely piece.
Mm. If it's going to be a short story where every word counts, I think you probably need to look at the paragraph about both his parents dying within a year of each other, leaving him a little money, and him talking to this pension people and doing his sums, because that's kind of too much information in a short story. But if it's going to be a longer piece, then I would have liked to have been taken on the journey of his emotions about this. So, you know, first his mother died, and then it was really hard to see his father trying to cope without her, and how he devoted himself to his father, and then when his father went as well and faded away, suddenly he was without a job, and then he realised, you know, so there's a kind of emotional journey, whereas saying they died within a year of each other and left him some money, we don't really need to know that in a short story, and in a longer story or in a novel, then I think we need to be taken with him on that. But that was really the only thing that I felt.
And on a similar line, I thought there were, if it's a short story, there are probably things that you could take out.
Yeah.
Just the very least in the event and things like that.
But also,
So that was. Otherwise, I thought it was great.
I kind of felt comfortable with those things because it was a little slow pacing. It helped with the pacing. Mm. And that's where he is. He's in this place relaxing and the pace is slower.
Mm-hmm.
And so I like the fact that these entries, and especially I didn't mind at all. I like the explanation about how he was able to retire early. I see your point. If it's a short story, then those things might have to be trimmed. But if it's a longer piece, I think they're lovely because it helps the pacing.
Yeah, I would actually like to see a bit more description, not for its own sake, but, you know, apart from the blue chairs, which is great, we're not getting a lot of colour and obviously
no smells.
I haven't quite got this, you know, what does the Cafeneo look like? What does the harbour look like? It's kind of, if you say there's a harbour, everybody has a different picture of a harbour in their mind, which is fine, that's okay, but I would have liked a bit more colour and description in it. The only other little thing, a bit like the donkey's eyes, or my eyes slid along the donkey, I've got Yanni's huge paw grasped Joe's. Has Joe got a huge paw as well, or has he got a more delicate hand?
I
have a huge paw as well. It's just that I queried it.
I didn't actually like huge paw.
I did. I did.
I
saw
Yanni
with a huge.
I use that a lot. Yeah, it is in a way a cliche, but how do you describe somebody
who's
got a
huge paw? I'd like to know about the friendship. Thing. You know, I was intrigued by the mention of friendships. I mean, you know, that's sort of a bit more than.
Yes, exactly.
Being
you want a little bit more information about these things. I'm also intrigued why he brings a big pile of books on with him. Or, you know, I mean, is that.
Oh, he loves to read.
But is it going somewhere? Is that part of the story?
Well, it could be.
But yeah, I thought about the friends as well. To know a little bit more about these friends he's made and the good experiences he's had.
Yeah, we want to know more about him.
Okay.
Yes, you very much.
Certainly do.
Thank you, Pat.
And if any of you have anything to add, Pat would love to hear from you on our Facebook group. And now it's over to Heather, who has a word of the week for us. Heather?
I was really stuck for what to say today. I racked my brains trying to think of something clever to match everybody else's. And I sat down and talked to my friend Google. And I found a website called Merriam-Webster's. And I found their word of the day. And this was on the 18th of January. Today I did my homework. And the word was teetotaler.
Oh, well, you wouldn't have known what that was.
And I have
written
down here. I've heard of that.
Something to do with Methodism.
So I did possibly still recovering from the excess of the festive period up here, made me smile. Right, it means one who practices or advocates teetotalism, one who abstains completely from alcoholic drinks.
Right.
Like us all.
Yes.
A person who abstains from alcohol might choose tea as his or her alternative beverage.
Oh.
But the word teetotaler has nothing to do with tea.
Oh.
More likely, the T that begins teetotal is a reduplication of the letter T that begins total, emphasising that one has pledged total abstinence. In the early 1800s, teetotal and teetotally were used to intensify the words total and totally. Much the way we might now say, I'm tired with a capital T.
Right.
Oh.
I am wholly, solely and teetotally absorbed in Wayne's business, wrote folklorist Parson Weems in an 1807 letter. Teetotal and teetotaler first appeared with their current meaning in 1834, 8 years after the formation of the American Temperance Society.
Ah. Blame the Americans.
Yeah.
So that is interesting, isn't it?
Yes, yeah.
I am totally fed up.
Right, here's a challenge. In the next week, we've all got to go around and see if we can drop it into a conversation. Naturally, without talking, when we're not talking about abstaining from alcohol.
Yeah. My heart began to beat faster because I thought you were saying, oh no, we can't have wine all week.
Brilliant. Thank you, Heather. As I said at the top of the show, Pat and Teresa spoke to crime writer Graham Smith just before Christmas, so let's listen to that interview.
We're very excited today to welcome Graham Smith, author of several best-selling crime thrillers, including the D.I. Harry Evans series set in Cumbria, the Jake Boulder series set in the US, and most recently, The Silent Dead, the first in a new series featuring Detective Beth Young. Welcome, Graham. Thanks for talking to us.
No problem. Thank you for having me along.
Graham, tell us a little bit about how you became a writer and where do you get your inspiration?
I became a writer somewhat by chance, I suppose. I've been a long-time reader, always crime fiction, right up to the famous five easier reads such as Dick Francis, Clive Cussler, into the more heavier noir novels as I got older. And a few years ago, I got an email from Lee Child's newsletter. It was saying that he was appearing at this festival at Harrogate called the Thiessen's Old Peculiar Crime Writing Festival. I loved the idea of it. I booked the weekend off work, got permission from her inside the doors, and then took off and had a fantastic weekend meeting a lot of my author heroes, like-minded readers and so on. One of the people I got chatting to that weekend was a man called Chris Simmons, who runs a website called Crime Squad. It's a review site. It was before the review blogs and everything came about, because this was back in 2009. I cheekily asked if he had any jobs going as a reviewer. And after writing out a review of Mohader's Pig Island, I got taken on as a reviewer. Then at subsequent Harrogates, I was meeting authors, conducting interviews and so on, and that really gave me a good grounding and something of a small standing place in the crime writing community. And a friend I'd made along the way was a writer of short stories, and he encouraged me to write. And after tossing a book over my shoulder for the umpteenth time, saying I could write better than this, I kind of had to put my money where my mouth was. So I set about learning the craft of writing. I wrote 30,000 words of a novel that would eventually become Snatched from Home, my debut novel. However, I got so far into it and I was doing terribly, so I really took time out to learn how to become a better writer. I learned as much as I could, spent 18 months or so concentrating on short stories to really, really learn the craft of brevity more than anything. As you probably notice, I waffle on endlessly, if unrestricted. So stories to hone my craft. And then because of that, when I went back to write the novel, I read the 30,000 words I'd previously written and thought, this is rubbish, and literally deleted the file from my computer and started again from
scratch. Oh, wow. That was a bold move.
It was the right move. The first 30,000 words were horrible. They just weren't working. The story was badly told. It needed to be told a lot better.
Right.
Twice as much work to try and sort them 30,000 words out than to rewrite them.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Even at that early stage of my career, I knew I'd made a pig's ear of it. I started again. Because of the position I was in with Crime Squad and everything, and being a hotelier in my day job, I was very fortunate to have connections in the community, crime writing community, and a venue at my disposal. So I put together a weekend of crime writing masterclasses called Crime and Publishment, where authors came along and taught classes to aspiring crime authors. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I was really adamant that had to go in the program was that I would get either an author or an agent to come along every year to teach people how to make a successful pitch. Not one of these rambling ones that go on forever, or there's no real relation to what they're wanting. So I was insistent that they come along, I'd find someone who would come along and do that for me, and then give everyone a private one-to-one 5 minutes to pitch.
That's brilliant. While you mentioned crime and publishment there, just remind us of the date for that this year.
Crime and publishment this year takes place from the 8th to the 10th of March. Our speakers are Zoe Sharp, Carol Ramsey, Luke Johnson, and the agent is Mark Stanton, better known as Stan, from the North Literary Agency.
Yeah. You said that you learned your craft. You decided that you needed to actually learn the craft. Did you do that just by writing, or did you actually do anything more formal?
I attended a one-day course at Harrogate. Course in the morning was Stuart McBride and Alan Guthrie, very informative. And in the afternoon it was Joseph Finder, New York Times bestseller. Mm-hmm. I really was learning from some good people. Again, I learned through my own crime and publishment, and a lot of the short stories I was writing then featured on various different blogs such as Thrillers, Killers and Chillers and so on. And there was a lot of peer feedback and everything in that those groups. You know, you could send a piece to someone, what do you think of this? And they'd come back to, well, I would tighten this, you know, I wouldn't kill them quite so horribly kind of thing. And toning, and so the works were polished, and even then on submission the editors would send back, yeah, I really like it, but might need to change this a wee bit. So you're learning all the time. And I can't speak for other writers, but for me, a lot of writing is about muscle memory. If I'm starting a new novel, we'll say we start, I don't write anything from now until the 1st of January. 1st of January, I start a new novel. The first few days, it seems like hard work getting down to writing and forcing myself to write for 2 hours or 1,000 words or whatever goal I do on a daily basis. But after a week, it flows, and it's muscle memory. Right. If you haven't been to the gym for 2 months, you're not going to get on an exercise machine and hit a personal best. You have to build back into it. And for me, writing's very much the same. Flow. When you're away from the computer or notepad, whatever you write on, your thoughts are always working. As a writer, your thoughts are always working.
Yeah.
But if you're not writing, you're not communicating those thoughts. It's like any job. You know, you take a heart surgeon away from his operating theatre for 6 years. He's not going to be as good the day he walks back in as the day he walked out.
You write a lot of police procedural. How do you get your inside information on that?
I'm a big fat cheat there. I read a lot of procedurals. I osmose a lot from those, and particular authors such as Colbury and Peter James are very big on police procedure. Learn a lot from reading their stories. I also fudge quite a lot of the details. As long as you know the basics, you know, things like about pace and, you know, Police and Criminal Evidence Act, certain forensics and common sense stuff, like it's not going to be the chief constable who does the door-to-door. Again, a lot of the time, police change their terminology for things and so on. Mm-hmm. We now have CSI investigators, or crime scene investigators in this country, whereas 10 years ago, they were all called SOCO. There's nothing wrong with having a character make a throwaway comment, like, get on to crime prevention, or whatever it's called this week. People are having to put a label on it for what it's called today.
Mm-hmm.
Be right at the time I was writing, might be right when it was edited. 2 weeks after the book comes out, if the term changes in the police, it's instantly wrong. Fudge a few of the details that way.
Mm. Right.
And the other thing about writing the police procedural is that you very much have to focus on the story rather than the procedure. A lot of what police officers do is hanging around waiting to interview people, filling out forms, making sure procedures. If you were to detail their days exactly, you would be writing a manual. I'm writing fiction. Yeah. I want someone to keep turning the pages, not to fall asleep reading it.
So you don't have a tame policeman in your advisory?
Colbury's a friend of mine, and he's worked with the police, so he's a good source. But I have other friends that have worked in various parts. I mean, I know a couple of lawyers, both in Scotland and England. I've got ex-cops, aplenty as writing buddies and so on. Yeah, they'll pick me up. Yes, one of my most used sources is actually a doctor. And I message her the most horrible questions on Facebook. Always come back with an answer. This wouldn't, you know, blah, blah. And it's more for about the kills. I try very hard not to show too many kills on the page.
Mm-hmm.
I show the effect they have on the investigating officers, on the family, on the pathologist who's got to make sense of it. I try and show the human aspect as much as the gore.
So in Detective Beth Young, you've chosen a female protagonist. Did this present any particular problems for you?
Presented a few, but as a writer, I believe in stretching myself. I don't want to write every, you know, a bald-headed, goatee-bearded, grumpy mid-40s character. That's too easy. With Beth, I wanted somebody right at the start of their police career. I wanted someone with a different perspective than the cynical, hard-bitten, alcoholic, with three marriages and crippling child support. I wanted someone to come in with a keen brain, but also a naivety. She's not yet hard-bitten. She's not yet cynical. A boss is very much that way, but I thought to have it as a female perspective will stop me very much putting my words into her mouth. That's the polar opposite, because I am the traditional grumpy middle-aged man.
The Silent Dead is the first, it says, in a new series. So do you have the series mapped out?
To a point. I mean, book two has been formally accepted by the publisher. It's going for proofread now. Book three is what I'm working on here in Derbyshire, and I've broken the 70,000-word barrier today, another 20,000 words, and that'll be done. So I hope to have that with my editor, hopefully before Christmas, but no promises, because I know she's planning to send me more edits any day now, so I'll get dragged away from this story. That's as far as technically as my contract for that series goes, but I love the idea of a series set. I don't know if you're familiar with the Roy Grace novels by Peter James. You know, he's got the thread about the missing wife, Sandy, that runs all the way through. I love that. And I've actually told Peter to his face that I'm more interested in the Sandy drama than the actual case now. So what I've done is I've put a thread throughout the Beth Young series. Essentially, there was a fight in a pub when she was undergoing a police training. She was running out and she got a bottle into her cheek. It was an accident. It was deflected away by the man it was intended for, but she got it. The two fighters scarped and they were never found and she hasn't got justice. So the thread through the novel is her seeking justice, seeking these men. Two kisses tattooed onto his neck. Identifier of him.
Right. Considering, you know, you're running a busy hotel, you seem quite a prolific writer as well. You must have a great discipline.
I do. And again, along with the muscle memory, discipline is very much a part of writing. You can't be a writer if you don't write. You know, you have to get your bum in the seat and produce new words. We all have different schedules. We all have different body clocks, life pressures, etc. I know some people who get up an hour early and do an hour's writing before the husband, the wife, the kids wake and they have to go to work. I know some who, like me, wait till everyone else is in the family's in bed, then have an hour's writing. Mm-hmm. You know, everyone has to find what works for them. Others I know finish work, they get home, stick something in the oven, and they'll write for an hour. The evening meal's cooking. It all balances out. There is no right, there is no wrong when it comes to finding a writing routine. Writing very much about what suits the individual.
But you're a sort of late-night writer.
I tend to be. Because of the way my job works with the hotel, quite often I get time off midweek when the rest of the family's at school or work or whatever. So I'm always found on a Tuesday sitting in my armchair with a laptop belting out 2,000 or 3,000 words.
I was interested in the fact that you did a mixture of forms. You did like short stories, novella, novel. Was that a deliberate policy or was that just the way things happened?
It was an idea I had. Once Snatch from Home had been accepted for publication, I spoke with the publisher and mooted the idea of a short story collection that introduced the five major characters in the novel, Harry Evan, John Campbell, Neil Chisholm, Amir Bharti, and Lauren Phillips. Sorry, to be well, since I wrote those characters, I just don't think there. But I wanted to write these five stories just to introduce them a little, because Snatch from Home really does hit the ground running and there's not a lot of time to fully introduce the characters. So I thought I would put them together. So I did that, sent it off, and the publisher came back and said, yeah, we love that, Graham. Can you do a short story collection or a novella to go with in between each novel? So it started off as my idea, but it got expanded upon. And, yeah, it seems to work. And again, it's a great way of using up ideas that aren't good enough. I won't say they aren't good enough. Aren't complicated enough to carry a full novel. And again, it kept my hand in writing shorter form fiction.
And it's interesting, you know, you're showing a different aspect of Cumbria than the usual Lake District tourist image.
Absolutely. And I don't think there's a tourist board in the country that likes crime writers. Underbelly. Cumbria is such a wonderful, gorgeous county. You've got the high fells, you've got the deep lakes. You've got probably a couple of hundred miles of coastline, you know, all different kinds of coastline. You've got rural villages with six houses. You've got the city of Carlisle, you know, with a castle where Mary Queen of Scots was once held. You've got all that kind of thing, but so many varied stories you can tell. Without going too far into it, the story I'm currently writing for Betty on 3 starts off in a very small village that's got maybe 30 houses. But it's a village I know relatively well, and it's great because I've got the small town murder as the opening. You know, when you live in villages, as I do, everyone knows everyone's business. You just know it today. They know it for the last 20 years and all the rest of it. So villages are full of secrets that everybody knows. So that's always a good place to be. But at the same time, still got the larger places like St. Carlisle that are anonymous. Workington, yes, and Keswick and Kendal will have a certain level of anonymity. But there's a whopping great tourist attraction in the middle of the county. All the tourists coming in, got all the strange faces, mixed nationalities. We've got a whole melting pot going on of strangers and so on. So there's lots of room there to play about with. with the woods and the coastline and the hills and all those deep lakes. So it's easy to dump a body.
Ideal, yeah. What do you think is the best piece of advice you were ever given?
In terms of, like, there's a lot. There's a lot I could say here. But my own one, the one I would always say to people, if you want to write a book, firstly recognise whether it's a crime or a romance or a historical kind of novel. And then once you've kind of got the bookseller's bracket for it, read 5 books in that style. You know, you can go for bestsellers, you can go for debut authors, but read 5 books that fit slap bang in the middle of that genre, and then write a 500-word critical review. Review don't have to be positive, but you have to read the book in such a way that you understand its flow, the emotions it gives you, what the plot does, what the characters do. And when you know that you've got to write a review of a book, you read them in that different way that allows you more understanding.
That's brilliant.
I'm a reviewing background. I know that what I've just said is a fact. It's what I did. I was most it. I didn't realise until I was starting to write that I was reading in a different way. I still read and review books now, friends' books for pleasure, still review for Crime Squad, and I find that it's great in terms of making me understand little bits of tradecraft. I see various bits and pieces that perhaps other readers wouldn't get. Some will see things that I don't see, but I pick up on little bits of tradecraft. I was speaking with an author friend at Stirling, put a passage in that aped a well-known TV scene. And what he'd done was he'd worked it so perfectly that he'd actually counted the syllables so it had the same musical beat to it. Yeah. And it's little things like that, that little bit of craft. How did he get it so good? And then you look at it and you work it out and you do that.
That was absolutely fascinating, Graham. Thanks very much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Lots of great crime writing information there, but I was particularly interested to hear about crime and publishment. Imagine a whole weekend devoted to writing and spending time with other people writing in that same genre. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And workshops and all the rest of it. And staying in a nice hotel in Gretna Green.
Mm-hmm. I did a course once up in Lancaster, 5 days in 1 week, on writing crime fiction.
Mm-hmm. So you were with just other crime writers?
Yes.
This is good. So Alison Robertson from our Facebook group, she put something up on the Facebook group, didn't she, about Retreats for You, who run a load of writers' retreats that are some are weekend, some are week long, and some are themed. So you can see the link on our Facebook group if you're interested in that kind of thing. And they're offering a pitch to the publisher weekend, which sounds really interesting too.
Yeah.
So are you up for that, Teresa?
What, pitch for the publisher? I don't think I'm ready for that yet. I mean, I'm always interested in writing courses. I've always found them a bit beyond my means. And also, like, if you're going to spend all that money, you want to be ready to get the most out of it. And I kind of think it'll be full of published authors who are kind of some way in advance of me. However, one did catch my eye, which was shared with us in the Facebook group by Alison McLeod, author of the wonderful novel Unexploded. And she's involved and is one of the tutors on a course called In Vino Veritas. Sounds good already. Which is
developing the theme.
Yeah. Anybody would think. Anyway, a 7-day full residential course in a Tuscan vineyard.
Oh my word.
And for 5 mornings you have a 3-hour writing seminar where you're together. And in the afternoons you're free to read, write, swim, explore, taste wine. It does sound rather nice. If you think of it as a holiday with a bit of writing thrown in, it does sound rather lovely, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And that's coming up in September.
That's lovely. The one, I think it's been in existence for quite a long time, and it up to several years ago, it was the only one I really knew about it, and I really did fancy it. And that was the Arvin Foundation, which I thought was local to me because they have a base at Hebden Bridge in sort of West Yorkshire. But apparently they originated in Devon, and they also have a centre in Shropshire. I think they started with poetry and fiction, or poetry and creative writing, but now they offer courses on poetry, fiction, non-fiction, memoir, songwriting and screenwriting, playwriting and radio drama. But the one I sort of investigated, probably because I'm more interested in, was the fiction writing course. And it came to throw levels of experience. You know, you, like Teresa was saying about, you know, you probably need to be at a certain stage. This apparently caters for all levels of experience. And apparently the formula is always the same. There are two professional writers, I think about 8 to 16 guests, and a guest reader appears during the week. Because it's a retreat, because there's no Wi-Fi, and even mobile signal, on the Devon one anyway, there's about a 5-minute walk down the lane before you can get a mobile signal. So, but it's not all about the isolation. There's also sort of coming together. There's communal dining, and participants are encouraged to share how far along in their writing journeys they are. I love this. Staff provide the breakfast and the lunch, but the dinner is actually prepared by the writers themselves.
Oh, I'd love that.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Sounds like a new fostering.
Yeah. Except there's a rota, and it is overseen by the house cook, and they work with recipe cards and so on. But it does sound quite
mucking in.
Yeah. But like the one that Therese mentioned, the mornings there are workshops with the tutors, and then the afternoons are given over to independent work. And there are also some one-to-ones with each tutor. Now, that comes in at 5 nights from £745. But, again, that includes your accommodation, your meals. But there are some shorter courses available, but they're still quite expensive.
I think they have somewhere in the far north of Scotland as well.
Yes, they do. Yes, Inverness.
And we were lucky enough to hear from Alison Bronning-Robertson, who is a writer and a member of our Facebook group, who's actually been on the Arven retreat. So over to Alison.
Some years ago, I took part in a writing retreat at Moniac Moor in Scotland. This was then part of the Arven Foundation, although now it's a Scotland Creative Writing Centre. The Arven Foundation run courses led by acclaimed writers in different genres. As such, it isn't really a retreat, as there's a workshop element, but there is plenty of time for solo writing. My chosen genre was crime fiction, and my mentors at the time were Val McDermid and Louise Welsh. I arrived at the station and was collected along with all the other writers. I found it quite difficult at first, as I'm a bit shy, and there are 10 or so participants. I soon made friends, though, and can honestly say I had a really good time. Lots of laughter all round. In advance of the course, you send 2,000 words of a work in progress, and I sent the opening of the novel I was working on. The format of the day is morning workshops led by one or other of the writers, followed by free writing time, and then early evening you get a one-to-one critique of each of the mentors. On the evenings you aren't having your critique, you will either go for a walk, carry on writing, socialise, or help prepare dinner. All meals at the Arven Foundation are prepared by the participants. Breakfast and lunch are a buffet, but in the evening you prepare a meal with a team that you're allocated. I was a little bit worried about this at first, but actually all the recipes and the groceries are provided, and it turned out to be great fun and a really good bonding experience. On the Wednesday, we had a guest visit, and in this case it was Natasha Cooper, who talked about her work and read a little. On some courses they have agents or publishers, depending on the genre. In the evening, wine is available, pay as you go, and we had entertainment in the form of quizzes set by the mentors. These were really funny, especially after the wine. On the last evening, everyone gets a chance to read their work and get some constructive feedback and help from the group, and I left feeling that I really had an opportunity to work on my novel and have encouraging feedback from the mentors, and this was really rewarding because they were really well-respected professional writers. The Arven courses are not cheap. I was lucky enough to get mine as staff development, as I was teaching creative writing at university. Normal prices are from £545 for the shorter courses, which run from Monday to Thursday, or £795 for the longer Monday to Saturday courses, which is one I took. However, there are bursaries available for both teachers and low-income writers, which can cover quite a lot of the cost. I've looked at Moniac Moor as well, and they're a little cheaper than the Arven Foundation. Arven have retreats in Shropshire, Devon and Yorkshire, and you can find out more on their website. I'd really recommend the courses. They're a real investment in you as a writer.
We've had a message from Kirsten Pell, who's one of our listeners, who's been talking about the retreat she went on at Pondon Hall, which is on the edge of the Yorkshire Moors. And apparently it was the house that was Emily Bronte's inspiration for Wuthering Heights. She went on a a retreat run by Rowan Coleman, and the retreat was called Writing with Heart and Soul. What Kirsten says is, unlike its literary version, Pondon Hall is warm and cosy with roaring fires that are always tended and tummies kept full of glorious home baking. In the Earnshaw room, you can sleep in a replica box bed next to the very window where Cathy's ghost returned to look for her Heathcliff. In such surroundings and with Rowan's excellent guidance, it was impossible not to find inspiration. Rowan took us out at dawn to watch the daybreak. The same beautiful surroundings Emily Bronte loved. And wonderful hosts Steve and Julie Atkhurst are passionate about the history of Pondon Hall, keeping the spirit of the Bronte sisters very much alive. They also cared deeply about their guests and can't do enough for you, even taxiing guests to and from the local pub. I felt privileged to have been able to attend and hope to go back someday. Well, thank you, Kirsten. That's really nice to hear. Thank you.
Heather, what have you got for us?
Well, I'd like to thank you all for a wonderful morning when you sent me off to do my homework, the writing retreat. Beautiful pictures and wonderful countryside and hotels and absorbed in it. I found a few that were really quite interesting. One called Heart and Mind, which said empowering women through literacy. And it talks about Mexico, Portugal, Argentina, Costa Rica, to name but a few. And I say that I got totally, you know, sort of absorbed in the pictures and not really very much on the retreat. There's also retreats in Ireland and Greece. If you've got 1,000 or so tucked away somewhere, then you can go.
Well, if you just want a competition,
yeah, they did sound quite expensive. I didn't realise there would be so many websites and adverts about retreats either. I thought there'd only be a few. But the two that I particularly like, one was Spread the Word, mainly because it's UK-based, so am I, and they were a lot more affordable. A lot of them around London. And starting with day courses, which are very similar to the ones you've talked about already.
Yeah.
And they have specialist ones, and they have crime writing sessions and, you know, various other topics where you've got a specialist to come in. And the other one was called Writers HQ, and Seth told me about this one. And these are really affordable. These are £35 for a day.
Yeah.
Much more accessible for people. Mm-hmm. And it's a bit like you said, it's not specific. So people... just you turn up and do your own piece of work. Mm. There are people there to advise you. And it sounds a lot more low-key, a lot more... You know, sort of,
and they're all over the country, aren't
absolutely.
They?
Absolutely, yeah. Yes. Yeah. But I had a lovely morning.
Linda, what about you? Have you been on a residential course?
I have. It was lovely. But I want to ask, do any of these that you've mentioned offer a scholarship?
The Arvin Foundation does. There are bursaries and so on available.
Because the one that I attended back in the early 80s, the Wesleyan Writers Conference, that's in Middletown, Connecticut in the United States, about 2 hours from New York. But each of the attendees, and I did have a scholarship to that one, and so it was quite affordable for me. But each of the attendees were assigned to meet with, you know, a famous author who was going to critique your work that you'd sent earlier. And my critiquer, my famous person was Lois Gould. I don't know if you're familiar with her work, but she had a book on the bestseller list of the New York Times for about 7 weeks called Such Good Friends. And then Otto Preminger directed the movie that came with that. So anyway, I went there on a scholarship, and she wasn't crazy about my work. I mean, what?
There's a theme emerging here. We've got Kurt Vonnegut one week.
She was mildly encouraging. She told me some things that she felt I could do to improve it. So it was very nice. But I remember just having a lovely conversation with her, and I asked her how she wrote, what were her writing habits? And she said, she writes in the bed in the mornings. She wakes up to a lot of pillows, and she just sits in the bed and writes. And I thought, sounds so cozy. It was like a long weekend. But we did have our housing and meals and everything covered. It was a wonderful time. I highly recommend to anyone who can do it, go on one of these retreats, rubbing shoulders, talking about writing. It's just fabulous.
Getting rubbished by famous people.
Noticed, right? Because it was a few weeks ago I talked about Kurt Vonnegut trashing my work, and now Lois Gould has. Well, she didn't trash it. She just wasn't really excited.
Oh, well, I know. Love your work.
Yes, exactly.
We love you.
Yeah. Well, what about you, Steph? Have you ever attended a writing retreat?
I haven't actually yet attended a retreat, but next weekend, by coincidence, I am going to do an online retreat. Oh. And this is one which you do from your own home.
Sounds great.
And starts on Friday evening, and you get together with people from all over online, and you work with them over the whole weekend, finishing late on Sunday evening. And in fact, I spoke to the tutor of that course just a few days ago. He's Tom Bromley. We've met him before. He's a ghostwriter, a tutor. He's the director of fiction at the Professional Writing Academy. And he's also tutoring at a retreat in Spain later in this year. So I spoke to him about that as well. So do you want to hear that?
Yes.
Okay, here we go.
Hi there. How's it going?
Very well, thank you. I'm really looking forward to working with you again next weekend, and we'll talk about that soon. But first, I was really intrigued by the writer's retreat you're attending in Spain. It's a place called Casa Ana.
Yeah, it's a beautiful place. So I taught there for the first time last year. So there's an organisation called the Literary Consultancy that have literary adventures, as they describe it. So they have a week-long course, which is a kind of talk course. But actually, I really enjoyed my time there. It's actually beautiful. It's in sort of Andalusia, kind of up in the mountains. And so throughout the year, they run kind of regular sort of writing retreats. And these aren't talk courses, but they're there for people to go away and write. And there's a sort of mentor there, so you can book in and have kind of mentored sessions if you want as you're writing, or you can just go there to kind of escape and write. Yeah, it's an absolutely beautiful part of the world. I don't know if you know the book, Driving Over Lemons by Chris Stewart.
Yeah.
But I think he lives in a nearby village, so it's very much that kind of territory. It's very quiet. It's one of those villages you get to, and there's no cars in the village. You have to kind of park at the end and then kind of walk. So kind of lovely and quiet, kind of great place to kind of get away from it all and write. They're definitely worth doing. So I'm doing a session in March, and then they've got other people doing
What do you do? Are you the mentor?
I'm the mentor, yeah. So I will be there on hand. If people want to come and just write, they can come and write, or they can kind of book in and have sessions where I kind of read and discuss what it is they're writing. I think those writing retreats work quite well, and that it's getting that balance between having, I suppose, the space to go away and write somewhere, but still then in the evening you can then sit down and kind of chat to people as well. So you're not kind of completely isolated. It's sort of a nice... Yeah. A kind of balance between the two, I think. And I think those retreats are always nice where you go somewhere a little bit different that you don't know. There's something about being somewhere else that I think can help just kind of, you know, trigger the writing and then spark a bit of creativity.
Yeah. I'll put the link on our Facebook group. It sounds absolutely idyllic. So tell me, what can I expect this coming weekend?
The Faber course was, we wanted to try and do a sort of intensive course where the idea was to come up with a course where you could construct and write and come out at the end of the course in a couple of days with something concrete. So the idea is that you start the course on a Friday evening, and then hopefully by Sunday evening you've written a complete short story. And it's quite an intense course, as the name suggests. We do a lot of kind of reading, quite focused reading of different short stories, looking quite a lot at sort of influences and ideas, different ways into short stories. And then as we get on towards the end of the course on the Sunday, we're looking more at sort of endings and editing, how to kind of tweak that. But we interviewed, I've got some fantastic interviews we did with three short story writers, Erenison Okojie, Ellie Williams and Lucy Caldwell, all of whom are kind of fantastic writers and all come at the writing in different ways. So I think it's a really interesting mix. It's one of those courses that I think where you just have to kind of throw yourself into it and see where it goes. But I know when we ran it for the first time last year that people really enjoyed it and got a lot out of it. So I hope you will as well.
I'm sure I will. The reason I chose to go on it was because it's on the Who's It For on the website. It said, it's for novelists looking to stress test an idea. I've been writing short stories to try and work my way into a novel and get to know my characters. That's what I'm hoping to do, is to stress test the ideas that I've got. And yeah, I'd love to come out of it with a short story, because it's been talking about competitions, and it would be really nice to have a portfolio of stuff ready to get out to people, isn't it?
I think short stories are it's a great way of trying stuff out. Definitely. And I also think what we try to do is try to look at the sort of different ways short stories particularly kind of come into a story. But quite often you will find, even someone's writing a novel, that those starting points aren't any different to a short story. Quite often it's a small little thing. You know, it's an idea of a germ of an idea that kind of grows and develops, and you get a sense that it's somewhere longer. But I think sometimes with these courses, it's sort of thinking about, okay, I'd love to write a short story, but I don't know where to begin. So on this one, what we do is we give you five different ways in. So you experiment with different ways in, and then you pick the one that is kind of most applicable to you.
Yeah, brilliant. And you do it in your own home. You don't have to go out. You just put the heating on. As you say, get a big pot of coffee and an egg timer. And and tell all your family and friends that you're not allowed to be spoken to or approached for the whole weekend, and just get stuck in. It sounds great. And so how many of us are there?
So we've got a few places left. I think we're very nearly full up, but I know we've got a couple of places we can offer to kind of listeners of the podcast at a discount. So 25% off the standard £250 fee. Should I give you the details?
Tell me, and we'll make sure that we tell everybody else.
If you email academy@faber.co.uk is email address, and you say like one of the special Write Club, the podcast places, then we will allocate the discounted places, which are £187.50 rather than £250.
Wow, that's fantastic. Thank you. Just for us all. I hope a few of our listeners will join me then. That will be good. Fantastic. Well, I'm really looking forward to seeing you again Friday evening. I'll be there with all my pencils sharpened. Well, thanks for your time, Tom.
Not at all. Lovely to catch up.
Yeah. And we'll speak soon.
So there are still places available on the Faber course, and it's a fantastic opportunity. So if anyone has a lot of free time next weekend from 6 p.m. UK, all you have to do is email academy@faber.co.uk. If you'd like one of the special Write Club the podcast places, and you can join Seth and Tom Bromley for a real weekend workout. As Tom and Seth have said, it's going to be intense, but £187.50 very well spent. So go on, invest in yourselves.
What a bargain.
Okay, so it's almost time to end this episode of Write Club the Podcast, but before we go, let's ask Steph what she's reading at the moment. Steph, what's on your bedside table?
What's on my bedside table is a book by Siri Hustved called What I Love. I was quite surprised when I opened it, because the dedication is for Paul Oster, who you remember, the author of 4321, and I thought, well, that's odd. And then I found out that she's actually married to him, which is why it's for him. Anyway, What I Loved is very much a literary fiction. So I found initially it took a while to get going, but it's a beautifully written book. It's the story of two couples whose lives become enmeshed. Well, two men whose lives are enmeshed and their wives, and there were three wives altogether, but ultimately it's two couples. The relationships they have with their children, their careers, and what features quite heavily in it is the work of an artist, and he talks about other artists. And as I was reading it, I was feeling quite left out, because he was talking about a particular painting by Goya. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't understand what was grotesque, for example, about this particular painting. So I started to Google the art as I went through it. And actually, that was an education in itself. Damn it, I've forgotten the names of these pictures, but I could probably, in a party, sound reasonably knowledgeable now. But no, it's a lovely, lovely book. As I say, you may find it a bit hard going at first, but please stick with it, because there's grief, there's love, there's so many different things. And I cried more than once. And I do love a book that makes me cry. I do love a book. And relationships with children and children with each other. There's darkness, there's light, there's love. It's just a fantastic, fantastic story. So I'd recommend it to anybody.
Thank you, Steph.
And now, Sam Blake, author of the Cat Connolly series of books, what's on your bedside table?
And as a crime writer, you might think that there would be crime novels. And I do have lots and lots of piles of crime novels. But right now, because I'm starting a new book, I want to try and step away from crime. So I'm trying to read some books that are just totally different. So at the moment, I'm in the middle of this. This is absolutely awesome, this book. It's called Act One, because it's by a guy called Moss Hart. It's basically set in the 1920s and 30s in New York. And Moss Hart was started off as a playwright, and I don't think he became an actor. It's beautifully written. I mean, you just get totally sucked into 1920s New York and what's going on with his family. And he's got this crazy aunt, and he's just desperate to get into the theatre business. And I'm loving every second of it. But that is just awesome. So basically, it's a biography by Moss Hart. It's called Act One. And on the cover, it says, "The ultimate Broadway memoir by the master who raised the bar for us all." That's from Julie Andrews. So it's pretty good.
Okay, I'm going to retreat to my desk right now to see if I can enter a competition and raise the money to join Steph on that Fable Academy weekend. We so hope you'll join us again next week, when we'll be looking forward to some exciting events coming up this year, and Pat's going to help us with the difference between active and passive voice. Ooh. Something else I'm guilty of, as apparently. Don't forget to leave us feedback on our Facebook group. Tell us about any retreats or workshops you've particularly enjoyed. As a little writing exercise this week, why not take the time to write a 5-star review on your podcast provider's feedback page, Stitcher, iTunes, Audioboom. And to help us grow our audience, please recommend Write Club the podcast to 2 other people this week, not just 1.
Oh, homework, yes.
But just for our listeners. Yeah. See you next week, everybody.
Bye! Bye.